A kidnapping is always heartbreaking. But imagine how it would feel if your child was kidnapped and you were the first person to ever receive a ransom note for their safe return. Today, we talk about the United States' first official case of kidnapping that demanded money in return for the child. This child's name was Charlie Ross. Hey guys, and welcome back to my podcast. I'm your host Lulu, and how's it going, you guys? I'm so glad you're back. How's your week been? Mine's been pretty good. I've been dealing with a lot of back pain lately, so that's been fun, but, you know, that's just kind of my everyday life. Nothing new here. Everything's basically the same. I had some more audio issues recording this one. I got a new piece of equipment, I'm still learning how to use it. It's supposed to be super, super fancy. It looks super nice, but I can barely run my computer as it is, so, like, it's definitely a learning curve. But yeah, we're still here. We're talking about the case today, and I do want to let you guys know that next month I am going on a vacation. I do have plans on recording something and then having it set to upload when I am on vacation, so you shouldn't have any interruptions. But if for some reason that doesn't happen, you know, I'll let you guys know, when to expect, you know, not to see anything from me. And I'm only going for a week, so it's not super long. So you would really only miss one upload. But yeah, just a heads up, I am going to go on vacation next weekend. And right now I am planning on, you know, having something ready for that. But I'll let you know for sure, you know, when that time comes. Anyways, I have no updates for you guys. Everything's basically the same in my life, and that means that we can just jump right into today's case. Now, I might talk a little fast during this case. I do have 6 pages of information to go through with you guys, and normally when that happens, I will split it up into 2 parts, but I don't really want to do that with this case. I want to just cover it all in one go. It's just like one of those cases that, you know, I don't want to split up if I can prevent it. So I might talk a little faster than usual, try to get it all done, and it might be a little bit longer of an episode. So, and I know you're never upset about long episodes. But anyways, I had never heard of this case before, actually. I was kind of down a rabbit hole of a bunch of cases that I was looking into because I'm trying to find cases that, like, spark my interest again. I kind of hit a rut where I was just doing cases and they all just felt the same and they just didn't interest me. And me and Ray went down like a little rabbit hole together where we were like sending each other cases back and forth and kind of like, what about this one? What about this one? And that's when I found the case of Charlie Ross. What really interested me is that it was the like first official case of kidnapping that had a ransom note in the United States. It's very interesting to me that that was not something I've heard before. Not a lot of people have talked about, because I have never heard it. And I follow like 30 different people who talk about true crime. I look into this kind of stuff, but I had to be down a rabbit hole to find this case. And that's what I thought was really, really interesting. Especially because in my opinion, this case is a very interesting one. It sparked my interest. I read it all in one day. All of my sources I read in one day. I wrote it all in one day. I have no idea what that noise was. Sorry, something must have like fallen or something. Anyways, it's not like a case that is super obvious. I mean, we think we know who did it now, but I don't know. Anyways, I'll share it with you and I'll let you guys know how you feel. And maybe you feel like it's a boring case, but I really thought it was an interesting one. So let's move on to talking about Charlie Ross a little bit. Charlie Ross, at the time of his disappearance, was only 4 years old. He had 6 other older siblings. He had a father that was named Christian Ross, and I could not find the name of his mother in any of my sources. I do know that his mother, before he had gone missing, had actually gotten really sick at the time, and she was actually not even in the home when Charlie would go missing. She was in Atlantic City recovering. It's entirely possible that over the years her name has been lost, or it was just never recorded because she really wasn't a huge part in the case. But I do have the names of his older siblings. Hopefully I say the first one right. Stroughton, I think is how you say it. And then there was Harry, Sophia, Walter, Marianne, and Anna. From my research, and this is going off of what I understand, it looks as though Charlie was the youngest of the family. But I could not track down any other ages in that family. And in a lot of my sources, it said that Charlie had six older siblings. And I know I only listed off five of them. So either the research that I did, the articles and stuff that I read, misquoted and he was one of six children. Or there's another child out there that nobody mentioned. I only saw the names in one of my sources, but this is a very, very old case, so it's also possible that another name got mixed up, or just over the years things have been mixed up. Now, there is also another one of his brothers who is involved in this entire thing. This was another young brother of Charlie's whose name, like we talked about, was Walter. I do want to state right now that Walter's age changed in almost every single one of the articles that I read. So it is entirely possible that Walter's age is wrong, and he really can be as old as 8 or as young as 5. I wanted to make that very clear to you guys because this whole case sounds very strange and weird, especially with Walter being involved. The children were left out front to play, and so at first you'd think that, oh, he's probably on the older range, but then they got in with these people, and so I don't know how old his older brother was. I know he was older than Walter, and Walter was 4, so, and unfortunately, every single one of them stated a different age. Anyways, before I get too much into what happened, let's talk about where they lived. Charlie would live with his family in a neighborhood in Philadelphia. Now, this family, at the time that they moved in there, was making quite a bit of money, enough to buy a home in this very, very nice, expensive neighborhood. But recently, the stock market had crashed, and the family did own a pretty successful general goods store, but since the stock market had recently crashed, they had actually lost a lot of money. And the family at this point in time, when Charlie went missing, was in some pretty crippling debt. Then July 1st of 1874 would roll around. 4-year-old Charlie was outside with his older brother Walter when a familiar carriage would pull up to them. These boys had been playing outside fairly often at this point in time, and they actually had gotten used to seeing this carriage pulling up. Inside of this carriage were the same 2 smiling men that greeted them. The boys were so comfortable with this carriage at this point that they would run up to the carriage and talk to the men. These 2 men had been stopping by every single day starting June 27th to July 1st. At first, these men seemed very, very harmless. They would pull up next to the boys, say hello, make some small talk with them, hand them candy, and then ride off in their carriage. Today was a different day, though. These boys had gotten so comfortable with this carriage that they ran up expecting candy, and those same smiling men greeted them. Before they gave them candy or anything, they would begin to make some small talk with these young children, and they would talk to them about the upcoming holiday. If you are unfamiliar with the United States and the holidays they have there, Independence Day is normally celebrated on the 4th of July. So that was only a couple of days away. Now these men would ask these boys if they had any fireworks and what they were going to do. Then they informed them that they didn't have any candy with them today, but they were actually riding into town and asked if both of the boys, Charlie and Walter, wanted to jump into the carriage with them and ride into town where they could buy candy and fireworks. These boys were young and didn't see anything wrong with this, and happily climbed into the carriage and rode away from their home, with these two men. Now, this is where I'm going to touch back on Walter's age. To me, it feels like at first that he had to have been a little older at 8, but I don't think an 8-year-old would have just climbed into a carriage. So at that point, I feel like he's probably on the younger age of 5, but things jump so much that you really don't know, and it was a different time, and it was not as scary to see these people, to see, you know, strangers, and to put some trust in people you probably shouldn't. And unfortunately, that's what these two boys did on this day. Now, the neighbors would watch as the boys would run up to the carriage, greet these men like old friends, climb into the carriage, and ride away. Nobody stopped them, but the thing is these boys didn't act like anything was wrong. They didn't act as though they didn't know the men, so the neighbors didn't think anything of it. Now, at first, the boys were riding into town, and it sounds like, in only one of my sources, that Charlie would begin to cry during this ride. And he would begin to talk about how he wanted to go home, and he was ready to get out of the carriage. And at this point, the men had pulled up in front of the general grocery store that they were going to send one of the boys in to buy fireworks. They would hand some money to Walter and send him inside to buy fireworks. And again, hearing this, I lean towards maybe he's a little bit on the older side, but this was something that happened, you guys. Children walked to the store all the time and bought their parents cigarettes, and they bought candy, and so it was normal. Walter took this money and knew what he needed to do and would climb out of the carriage and walk inside the store. Now, I do want to mention that nobody witnessed Walter exit the carriage. They did not witness this carriage pull up to the store. They didn't witness him come out and walk into the store. But they did witness Walter walk into the store, and they did watch him as he began to shop for these fireworks. The story that we go off of is not necessarily witnesses watching Walter exit this carriage. That is from Walter himself. Finally, after a few minutes, Walter would walk up and down the fireworks section, decide what he wanted to buy, pick it out, and purchase it. At this point, it was time for him to walk outside and get back in the carriage and head home. But as he exited the store, he realized that the carriage, the men, and his brother Charlie were gone. This began to scare him because at this point he was left alone, and he would track down a man who he knew named Henry Peacock. Now, he would ask Henry for help, and because Henry knew who Walter was, he comforted the crying child and would take him home. At this point, when this man would bring Walter home, the father of the boys would begin to realize the gravity of the situation. At first, he had noticed that the boys were not in his front yard, but he had just assumed that they headed over to the neighbor's house because it sounds like they probably did that often, so he didn't think too much of it until Henry showed up with Walter, and Walter was talking about how he was in town and had taken a carriage with these men and how Charlie was with them, and Charlie was nowhere to be found. Before he did anything, which this sounds weird to me, but it's another time, you guys, he would go to the neighbors. The father would go to the neighbors and ask if they saw anything, and they would indeed tell him that both boys loaded up into a carriage and left, and that they acted like they knew the men. It didn't seem like anything out of the ordinary. They didn't think to check on them or stop them because these boys were so comfortable with them that they just assumed that it was like family or something. Their father would begin like his own investigation, and he decided that he was not going to inform his wife that their child was missing. Now, she was sick, she was away and trying to heal, and he really didn't want to put any unnecessary stress on her. And I can sort of see why, but also, like, if my child went missing, I would want my husband to tell me right away. That's just me, though. And I do want to bring up that I do not have a specific date that the authorities were contacted about this, meaning that It is entirely possible that Charlie's father went straight to the authorities when Charlie went missing, and it is also possible that he waited until the first letter would show up. I wanted to make that clear before we moved on, because on July 3rd, the family would receive their first note. Now, this note was full of a ton of grammar issues, a ton of misspelled words, and I'm going to read this note to you, but if you are interested in looking at this note, which I do feel like kind of, you can definitely tell more of the issues by looking at it versus me reading it to you. It is available online to look up. This note would read, "Mr. Ross, be not uneasy, you son will be all right. We is got him, and no power on earth can deliver out of our hand. You will have to pay us before you get him from us, and pay us a big cent, too. If you put the cops hunting for him, you is only defending you own end. We got him put so no living power can get him from us alive. If any approach is made to his hiding place, that is the signal for his instant annihilation. If you regard his life, put no one to search for him. You money can fetch him out alive, and no other exists in powers. Don't deceive yourself and think the detective can get him from us, for that is impossible. You hear from us in a few days." Now, it's pretty clear just by me reading it to you that they left out a lot of words. There was a lot of mistakes that not even are just like straight up spelling mistakes. There's just like a lot of mistakes in this letter. There are no capitalization in this letter. If you were to read it, there's none at all. Like I said, there's a ton of misspellings. They used the wrong, like, two, and like a lot of grammar issues. It was almost like this person wrote it very, very fast and didn't care, which happens in ransom letters. They really do write them as fast as they can and just send them out. Now, another note would show up a little while later. I did see that this was either the 6th or the 7th of July. Either way, this note would show up and demand $20,000, which in today's money is $400,000. That's a lot of money. This note stated that the money needed to be handed over for safe return of Charlie. But as we talked about earlier, the family was already in a lot of crippling debt because of that stock market crash, and they could not afford this $20,000. Because of this, or if he had already contacted the authorities got involved. And of course, when the authorities get involved, the press also gets involved. And they began to cover what was happening on newspapers, and the word began to spread very, very fast about what happened and where Charlie was. Now, imagine the surprise that Charlie's mother felt when she ended up reading the newspaper and coming across stories about her son. Because she did find out, and she didn't find out from the family. She found out from the press. During the initial phases of the investigations, the authorities were under the impression that the family, so Charlie, his dad, his brothers, sisters, whatever, had made somebody else in their family angry. And that the reason Charlie and Walter got in was because they knew who was in the carriage and that it was like family, like cousins or uncles. And they had taken Charlie as a way of getting back at the family. What sort of discounted this is that when they would speak to Walter about what happened, he would tell them that it was not their family, none of that happened, and it was just two men that had stopped by and given them candy for the past week. They were also under the impression, even though Charlie had been taken away in a carriage, that he was close. So at first they began going home to home. They would knock on neighbors' doors, let themselves in, and begin to just search the houses. Because of this, they would find like stolen things that had been reported and other things like that, but they never found any sign of Charlie. When they cleared all of the houses that they thought that he could be in, they would move to boats and other surrounding areas, but literally nothing showed any sign of Charlie. He wasn't there. Now, it's also not like Charlie's family was left completely in the dark once the authorities took over, because they continued to receive ransom notes. One after another after another, there was a total of 23 letters that had been sent to the family about Charlie. And then one day, a letter arrived from New York City, and then all communication ceased. Before we talk about what happened next, I did want to bring up that one of these letters did explain a very, very weird, in-depth way of paying the kidnappers the money. This involved painting a suitcase white, getting on a train and riding it, looking out a window, and looking for any signs of what to do next. Even without the money, the father would get on the train that day, the one that he was supposed to be on with the white suitcase, and begin to look for other signals and signs of where to go to meet these kidnappers. But this ride was pointless because there was nothing outside of the windows, there was no other signs of where to go, and the kidnappers didn't ever show up, basically. Now, the kidnappers had also told him in a note that he could communicate with them through the newspaper, that he would have to write something in a personal column of the newspaper. They would read it and then respond to a letter that they would send him. And they would kind of communicate like this for a long time back and forth until, like I said, after that letter from New York, everything fell silent and they never heard anything again. They also never saw any signs of where Charlie went. Because this was the first ever kidnapping with a ransom in the United States, it was pretty big news at the time. And basically everybody knew about it. Now the New York police also knew about it. They felt like they had finally found the very first ever pretty solid lead. Now another child had been kidnapped and another ransom note was left. This was already weird because this hadn't happened really before, and they would compare these notes, and the letters seemed to match, like the handwritings seemed to match. Then they began looking into the second kidnapping a little bit more, and it was very, very eerily similar to the disappearance of Charlie. That was the point that they concluded that these two happened by the same person, that they were connected, and they began to dig a little more into this second kidnapping to see if they could find anything that they couldn't the first time. And they did. They were able, it sounds like by the handwriting in both of the letters, to identify a man named William Mosier, who was a fugitive at the time, that was the handwriting of him. To make things even more interesting and obvious to them, William also had a partner that he worked with often named Joseph Douglas. And they knew that in Charlie's disappearance, two men had been involved. They also discovered that both of these men were staying in Philadelphia at the time of Charlie's disappearance, and they had driven a carriage that matched the exact description of the carriage that Charlie and William were taken in. At this point, it was so obvious that these were the men that were involved. They were confident that they could find them and find Charlie, so they began to look for them. And these men were nowhere to be found. They could not track them down. They kept searching for the men. They couldn't find them. It was really difficult and stressful because they were pretty sure that they were the ones involved. And then they caught a break. William, who they believed was the man who kidnapped Charlie, had been part of an armed robbery of a judge's home, along with Joseph. So they would head that way, to arrest both men that had to have been responsible for Charlie's disappearance, find out where Charlie was, and bring him home, dead or alive. But when they would arrive, they would discover that William and Joseph had both been shot during this robbery. Now, what had happened was an alarm on the home they were robbing went off, and the brother of the judge who was living next door at the time heard the alarm. He knew somebody was robbing the home, and he would gather a small group of his friends to head that way and defend the home. When they would get in, both men would be met with this group of other men who all had guns, and they would shoot both of them. William had been fatally shot, and Joseph was alive, but was fatally wounded, and they did not expect him to survive for very long. So they hurried along the process, and they talked to Joseph. Joseph knew that he was dying, and he had actually said because he was dying, there was no point in keeping it a secret any longer, and he confessed to the kidnapping of Charlie Ross on his deathbed. But when they asked him where Charlie was, he claimed that only William, his partner, knew where Charlie was being held, and alluded to the fact that Charlie was still alive. He informed them that he was in the carriage, he was involved in the kidnapping, but that William was the mastermind, and they couldn't do anything. He could not help them anymore, but confirm that they were both involved. He is quoted in saying, "Men, I won't lie to you. My name is Joseph Douglas, and the man over there is William Mosher. He lives in New York, and I have no home. I am a single man and have no relatives except for a brother and sister whom I have not seen for 12 years. Mosher is married and has 4 children. I have $40 in my pocket that I made honestly. Bury me with that. Men, I am dying now, and it's no use lying. Mosher and I stole Charlie Ross." He would inform the authorities that he had absolutely no idea where Charlie was, and that William was the one in charge of keeping the boy alive and keeping the boy hidden. But because William was dead, he and the authorities had no way of knowing where Charlie was. Both of the men would die. Once they were dead, they decided the next thing they needed to do was absolutely confirm that they were involved. So they would bring in little Walter again to look at these dead bodies and let the authorities know if they were the men who they climbed into the carriage with that day. And Walter confirmed it. They were the two men that took them into town that day. There was a third man that they did believe had some responsibility, and he was still alive. Now, this man was also named William. This William was also a police officer in Philadelphia around the time that Charlie went missing. He was not a very good police officer, and he had worked with the two men in some of their crimes. They would attempt to try this William for the kidnapping, but because there was absolutely no evidence at all that he was involved, nobody was able to charge him, which I think is good, because even if he was involved in some way, they really had no grounds to stand on with that. Like, he wasn't even in the carriage the day that Charlie got taken. Years and years and years would pass, and nobody would ever be able to find Charlie. There was a lot of cases where some other men had come forwards and claimed that they were Charlie, claimed that they looked like the family, or they remember being kidnapped, or they remember, you know, living in a cave until they got rescued and all of these other, like, random things. Every single time, though, that somebody had come forward saying and claiming that they were Charlie, they were pretty easily disproven. There was one case that they did rule him being Charlie. The family refused this and said that there was no way that Charlie was alive at this point, that he wasn't Charlie and he was faking it. And it does sound like there was some DNA testing done and they were able to conclude that he was not Charlie, which is really, really sad for the family. The family, even with as much debt as they were in, had actually spent about $60,000 in their whole lifetime searching for Charlie. They just wanted to bring him home, even if it was just his body. And even though they spent so much money, they desperately searched for Charlie, they basically had the men responsible everybody in Charlie's family would die. And nobody would be able to ever bring Charlie home. Charlie's father would be the first to die in 1897. His mother would die in 1912, and Walter, who was with Charlie that day, would die in 1943. Eventually, the home that they had stayed in would be knocked over, and there would be a church that would be built on the property and still stand there today. Even though we believe we know who was responsible for Charlie's kidnapping, we have never, ever been able to bring Charlie home. We've never been able to find his remains. We've never been able to find somebody who was Charlie. We don't know what happened to him that day. And what really, really breaks my heart of the whole situation, you guys, Charlie was a 4-year-old little boy who got taken. They pretty quickly found the men involved within the same year that Charlie was missing. It was alluded to the fact that Charlie was still alive when both of the kidnappers died. But if William was the only one who knew where Charlie was, it's possible that little 4-year-old Charlie would die on his own if he was locked in a room somewhere, hidden in a cave, tied up in the woods, God, who knows where, and nobody else knew where Charlie was. And only William? It's entirely possible that Charlie would sit there alone day after day until he just died. And that is so sad to me. I really, really hope that Charlie was with another family, that they kidnapped him and either honestly murdered him when the police got involved, as bad as that is to say, or they handed him to a family that didn't know it was Charlie and he grew up and had a normal life with his family and then died and we've just never been able to confirm it was him. Because I cannot stand the idea that this little 4-year-old could have been locked in someone's basement in a secret room alone for weeks and weeks until this little 4-year-old just starved to death. That breaks my heart. To this day, we don't know where he went. We honestly don't even know for sure if the two men that died were the ones responsible. This is a heartbreaking case that has led us to teach our children to be more careful of strangers and to never accept candy from strangers.
There may be false or misleading information throughout this podcast. All facts have been researched to the best of my abilities, but accidents do happen. If this is a story you are interested in knowing more about, I highly recommend doing your own research. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.